Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I'm your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Health Matters Shutdown Show. We are celebrating the fact that after a brief period of shutting down, our legislators in Washington have decided maybe they should work. I have to admit, I'm a little bit envious of a person who decides just to shut down the company they work for, in essence. That would be handy if you gave the employees that choice. But our legislatures have it. They have used it judiciously, could we say, just shutting down for a brief period of time. Meanwhile, we're at Health Matters, we're always under pressure to shut down.
It was just a short way to save some, you know, save some money, right?
Yeah.
Avoid 2 or 3 days of pay.
Right.
Not.
And so we're now they're up and running for at least for the present time.
What they do it? What they do? A 2 month CR, continuing resolution,
something like
that.
I think
they did something. Yeah, yeah.
3 days shut down, and everyone survived. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. And here, you may remember a couple months ago we had another person on the show named Shelley, and then we sent her to Isomville to do a traffic report during the last snow and ice storm. She made it back to civilization. Lost some weight.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, a little bit of frostbite. And to top it off, her new book, Death by Traffic Report, will be out next week. So back to the show after a prolonged absence and back to civilization as well. Assistant professor with the University of Kentucky Physician Assistant Program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And
that other guy.
Yeah, other guy from the University of Kentucky, Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, to tell you, as he always does, in his inimitable fashion, how to access Health Matters on the World Wide Web. Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
WMKY.org is where you will find Moorhead State Public Radio's website, and that is where the Health Matters website does reside. There you can find a list of the shows. You'll find just a short summary. No, we can't put all the shows on there, and so you will have to look at a list of the most recent shows. But, hey, maybe you heard something. Maybe you wanted to hear something again. Maybe you actually heard the show for the first time. You want to hear some more of them. You get the audio of the show right there at WMKY.org. After that, we encourage you to jump over to Facebook.com. Yes, we're old. Yes, we like Facebook. Look for Facebook.com/HM Radio Show, and there you'll find a fan page just for this show. Leave us some feedback, leave us comments, let us know some show topics, read what we've posted. You might find something humorous, you might find something noteworthy. You'll probably find something about Eric Kahn. There's all kinds of things out there on our fan page at facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today, Hypertension Guidelines. We're going back to a previous set of guidelines. When you treat your high BP, remember these guidelines three. These guidelines come from the American College of Physicians and the American Academy of Family Physicians, and we want to remind you of these guidelines. Now, we've been talking about the new American Heart Association guidelines. They are looking to treat blood pressure when it gets above 130 on the top number and when it gets above 80 on the bottom number. We generally, for years, have accepted 140 over 90, but here are the, from January 17th of 2017, from over a year ago now, here is the American College of Physicians and American Academy of Family Physicians guidelines. Number one, initiate treatment in older patients, and this is specifically for older patients, people age 60 years and older. Initiate treatment for persistent blood pressure at above 150. To lessen the risk for mortality, stroke, and cardiac events. Remember, the American Heart Association, they say that once it gets to 130, if you have a high risk of having a heart attack, you need to go ahead and start on medications. The American College of Physicians says, well, if it's above 150 and you're over age 60, then that's when you start treating. Consider guideline number two. And consider initiating or intensifying your medical treatment in older patients if they have a history of a stroke, in order to reach a target systolic blood pressure of less than 140. And then the third one is consider initiating or intensifying medical treatment in older patients at high heart attack risk, at high cardiovascular risk, to reach a target systolic blood pressure of less than 140. So again, initiate at 150. Consider intensifying if people have a history of stroke. and also consider initiating or intensifying to get it below 140 if people are at high risk of stroke. And that's it. They went over the, at the time, 1 year ago, the totality of the literature, and they said, we think these are reasonable guidelines, strongly supported by the literature. The problem with going lower than this is the overall mortality may or may not be improved. You're going to put a lot of people on medications. You're going to get medicine side effects. Now, in our second fractional portion, we'll remind you about the American Heart Association, but that are these are the guidelines that were brought out by the American College of Physicians, American Academy of Family Physicians last January, and we wanted to remind you of those. When you treat your high BP, remember these guidelines three. Our first article came from BMJ Case Reports, one of my favorite, my new favorite journals. And here's the initial, this was a case report, and here's the first sentence. Spontaneous perforation of the pharynx is an unusual condition.
I would agree.
Sounds like it.
Yeah. So right away, the pharynx, again, being the back part of the mouth, they, what people would call their throat, a spontaneous perforation of their of your throat is a rare condition. And, yeah, that's true. And that also gets your attention. So here's the case presentation. A previously fit and well 34-year-old man presented to the emergency department with acute onset of pain in his throat and change in his voice after a forceful sneeze. He described a popping sensation in his neck and some swelling on both sides of the neck after trying to halt a sneeze by pinching his nose and holding his mouth closed.
This doesn't sound good.
No, it was not good at all. Again, you've got your diaphragm and your chest are going to forcefully exhale air with a force that is literally staggering. I mean, you know, this can stop you from walking straight when you sneeze. And you decide you're going to shut out any way for the air to get out. And so what he did essentially was he blew up his throat. When they did the examination, they found a crackling and popping in the skin and, of his neck. There was air out under the skin, so it's sort of like those packing
bubble wrap.
Yeah, so it would pop like that. They got an X-ray. They could see that there was air into the skin there, the neck, the throat. In fact, was ruptured. They put him in the hospital, gave him feedings by tube. Because obviously they couldn't have food going out into his neck. And they did administer some antibiotics in case he got an infection. They held him for 7 days and then released him and said, don't do that.
Yeah, you think?
And so the case report, their conclusions, halting a sneeze by blocking the nostrils and mouth is a dangerous maneuver and should be avoided. And we, in this January cold and flu season, we could not agree more. The condition is called something called Boerhaave syndrome. We'll sometimes see that with people who throw up violently. And they rupture usually their esophagus, but he ruptured the back of his throat.
So Tony, I got to ask this question: is there a way to throw up nonviolently?
I've not found one yet. I did a lot of research on that over the past couple of weeks. So
I was going to say Shelley's been practicing and not found any solution.
I mean, when has anybody ever nonviolently threw up?
I think, though, you know yourself. I mean, there are times. Well, all right. So you went down this road. I will continue
it's
down
pretty,
this road.
It's a pretty violent act. Let's be honest.
There are times
your body
when it's more
is
violent
saying
than others.
Something.
And there are a couple of things. You can tear the esophagus, and sometimes that can actually produce bleeding because you tear one of the veins. That's called a Mallory-Weiss tear. But this Boerhaave's thing, it's not very common at all. And what happens is you tear a big enough hole that the stomach contents can actually get out into your chest. That's the most common form of Boerhaave syndrome. As a matter of fact, he described it. Baron Jan van Wassenaar, I'm reading this, obviously, 1724, a Dutch admiral, died of this condition. Again, the you have to correct it surgically, and in 1724 they didn't have the surgical techniques, so this guy died. But what happened to our more recent guy in the back of the throat? I have not seen that ever, nor have I read about it, which is why it made this case report. But it just reminds you, I mean, you know, sneezes need to be let out.
Okay. The thing is I probably went through, and this is sad to say, but I probably went through a period of my young adult life where I did that. I didn't, you know, it was a way to contain any, you know, I mean, just, it seemed more sanitary than, you know, just sneezing everywhere. It was before, but boy, you can't do it now. It's just bad. Once you realize the kind of damage you can do.
Well, there's some people who are cute little sneezers. You're not that person.
I'm not any of those statements.
No, just a little. You know,
there's
it,
no,
you know.
There's, you can't use little, and yeah. You can't use cute. Those just don't exist in the vocabulary that describes me on anything. You either, Tony.
I know.
You either, Tony.
I mean, there are times, you know, when you really get into the sneeze. You know, I mean, you're not here to have a small sneeze.
Oh, no. You know when I started getting into sneezes, right, is when you taught me sneeze like Dracula.
Oh, so you
got it. Oh, yeah. Then you throw the arm up, you give it a big song and dance, and, you know, you let everybody in the room know you're Dracula.
I always do my eyebrows. I don't know if you
there you go. Yeah. Well,
we talk about coughing and sneezing into the to the crook of your elbow, which prevents the germs from spreading. And so when I do that, I have to do something with my eyebrows because, you know, like you said, you look like Dracula. So
right.
It's probably childish that I do that, but I always do that.
Well, to me, it's the cape, Tony. Not really.
Yeah. So, but the point is, you know, I'm sorry there's a sneeze. Obviously, you want to, if you sneeze into the crook of your arm, you're not going to spray the contents of whatever's in your nose all over the room. But the idea of trying to pinch your nose and just stop the sneeze from coming out, again, this is a very forceful thing, and you don't want to do it. This guy was fine. He's 34 years old. After a week being fed through a tube, they felt that he had healed enough. The air had gotten out of the tissues around his the back of his throat, and they felt comfortable letting him go home. But my goodness, why in the world would you do that to yourself? That just that's a bad idea. I've heard different ways, you know, of in general of managing sneezes. Never found anything that worked. You know, they drink lots of liquids or something, eat something sweet real quick if you're in the midst of a sneezing fit, or if you're trying to hold a sneeze. You know, you remember they used to put the finger under your nose. You remember that?
Oh yeah,
on the cartoons they always did that. I don't think that ever did any good at all.
Made me
laugh. I mean, if you're not in a cartoon,
made you laugh.
Makes me laugh now. But if you're not in a cartoon, I don't think that necessarily works. But it is. I mean, the violence of a sneeze. I've gotten out of my lane in driving when I sneezed.
Now that's a sneeze.
That was a sneeze. Yeah, I got this. My new car has a.
So
a
what
lane
do you do in the snow when you're
off.
Driving in the snow and you have to sneeze?
Well, I mean,
you could spin the car.
Yeah, but you can't. You can't just stop.
Yeah, but you could do a 360
or sneeze.
Know, I can just see you now. You're doing a 360.
The thing to do is not to pinch your nose and try to suppress it. You let it happen and try to stay in the right lane.
You don't have time. Don't you dare start another article.
No, I'm not.
You got time for one more sneeze.
No, we're gonna take a break here. Try to have some budget negotiations and see if we can continue to fund the program for our second fractional portion. You are listening to Health Matters. Why not take a break and join us back on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Health Matters Shutdown Show. We don't have a budget, but if we have one, we would just go ahead and shut the show down. Just as a matter of principle. Our sponsor for the second time, Hypertension Guidelines, when you treat your high BP, remember these guidelines three. The American College of Physicians, the American Academy of Family Physicians, 1 year ago, they recommended three guidelines for adults ages 60 years or older. Number one, you start treating people with persistent systolic top number blood pressure above 150 to lower their risk for mortality, stroke, and cardiac events. Two, you consider initiating or intensifying it to try to treat to less than 140 if they've had a previous stroke. And then finally, three, if they have a high risk of heart attack or stroke, also consider trying to get it below 140. At no point was there any cut point below 130 considered by these guidelines. Now, again, in this fractional portion, we'll talk a little bit more. Well, as a matter of fact, we might as well go ahead. We'll talk some about the what happened with these new guidelines. And, again, another explanation of them, because I think that's really important. But our sponsor, hypertension guidelines, when you treat your high BP, remember these guidelines three. Now, we, the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology, and some other organizations said we should lower the threshold for treatment to 130 over 80. A person who is in the 130s and in the 80s should be treated. If they have a significant risk of having a cardiac event, go ahead and start them on medicine in the 130s. And again, for people, and this is all people ages basically 18 to 88, all people should follow this same guideline. They felt that there was actually a greater benefit in elderly people. The American Academy of Family Physicians said no. We refuse to endorse those guidelines. The American College of Physicians, and these are two big groups that are primary care groups. They treat a lot of patients. The American College of Physicians did not refuse to endorse them, but they published an editorial that is critical of them, and so they are certainly not going to endorse these new guidelines. So now we get into a budget shutdown level discussion, negotiation about who uses what guidelines, and I think that's going to get interesting. But here from the American College of Physicians, published in their journal called the Annals of Internal Medicine, hypertension limbo, balancing benefits, harms, and patient preferences before we lower the bar on blood pressure. And they mentioned these criticisms of the American Heart Association guidelines. They said, one, this thing may shift attention from a healthy lifestyle to more drugs. It's important to consider the ramifications of labeling people with no symptoms as being unwell before expanding the disease definition. So if you think about it, all of a sudden, you who were doing fine, now you have the disease hypertension. You're trying to treat it with lifestyle. What's going to happen to your insurance rates? How worried are you going to be? How often are you going to see the doctor? And how long will we let lifestyle issues work on your lifestyle before we start using medications? Would we not be better to try to insist that everyone to try to improve their diet, their activity, and so forth? So that's first criticism. Second criticism, if you use this recommended risk calculator, and again, they talked about a risk of heart attack of 10% or greater, everyone age 79 or older would be on medication. You got a 10-year risk, and there are very few people in their 70s that have the ideal blood pressure of 120 on the top number. Third?
Do you think that's good?
No.
I mean, to me, that I would think the you want to try to maintain a lifestyle that keeps you off as much medication as possible, and to say that 100% of 70-year-olds are going to be on medication for that just seems wrong. It seems like there's just something wrong with that.
Yeah.
To the layperson over here, the non-doctor on the other end of the room.
No, I absolutely agree with it. I think the burden then becomes, there's so many things about this. And you take a 79-year-old person who has no symptoms, and that's quite possible. This guideline would apply to a person who's 79, has no symptoms, but let's face it, at 79, you've got a pretty high risk of having something with your
heart.
You've
got one symptom. You're old.
Yeah, you're old.
And, that's good, right?
So the question is, if you have no symptoms, you're age 79, would you start a blood pressure medicine to try to help you to live longer? And I think by the time I get age 79, I'm probably eating pie for breakfast.
I'm eating ice cream.
Okay.
Stick your pie, I'll take ice cream.
My mother-in-law ate cherry pie for breakfast when she was in her 80s.
Yeah.
And I always thought that I want to get to that age where I can eat cherry pie for breakfast.
I'm pretty sure when I get to that age, I'm eating ice cream at every meal. Every meal.
Shelly, right. You're nodding your head, but
With your blood pressure medication sprinkles?
Yeah, exactly. At that age, I really won't care about my blood pressure. Right? Matter of fact, thinking about my blood pressure will only make my blood pressure go up.
Yeah. Well, you have a shortened time frame for benefit from treating high blood pressure at that age. There are some trials that indicate that it may be beneficial for cardiac disease. That is, it may lower your rate of cardiac disease. Keep in mind, though, not have it written on your tombstone, well, at least he didn't have cardiac disease. It doesn't really give you any advantage. So there are other things that come in, things like cancer and other causes of death that are more frequent in people in their 80s.
You know,
and so going full bore after heart disease prevention may not be the best strategy. At any rate, back to this. So we've got a problem then. We're labeling, again, half the population is going to have high blood pressure. Maybe we can work out with the insurance companies, but it's not clear that there aren't some serious financial consequences as well as health consequences, because it's going to be hard to stick with a blood pressure level labeled as hypertensive and not start medications. How long will you give the lifestyle changes to have an effect? Secondly, again, elderly people, all of them are going to be on medication. That's going to be, for a lot of our senior citizens, that's going to be a difference. Third, they talked about the evidence. The American Heart Association, their own review, found no reductions in all-cause or cardiovascular mortality if you have a target less than 130 versus higher targets. Risk across, if you did get to 130, the risk reduction was 1.1% for all-cause mortality and 0.5% for cardiovascular mortality. Once again, would you take a pill every day that lowered your risk of dying by 0.5%? That's not a huge one. The other thing is, four trials enrolled people with kidney disease. None of that showed benefits, even though they are recommending it for treatment of kidney disease. If you look at people above age 60, there are only two trials showed any significant improvement, and they did have methodologic problems. Finally, for diastolic blood pressure, no evidence from any trials to indicate that you should get down lower than 80. There's just simply no evidence there. So, finally, the guideline does not recognize or assess harm of treatment. Possibly cognitive decline, increased falls and fractures, more problems with dizziness and passing out, and other common problems. And the other thing, and we may get to this more later in the show, is when you add a medication, that's one thing if the only problem they have is high blood pressure, but most people in their 80s are going to have three or four different diseases, and all of a sudden you're pushing 15, 20 medications. You're putting three on them for blood pressure, plus all the additional medications they're on. You're basically adding a lot of medications to people's regimens. So for those reasons, the American College of Physicians criticized the guidelines. The American Academy of Family Physicians refuses to endorse the guidelines, these guidelines that created a new set point for treatment of 130 over 80 rather than 140 over 90. And keep in mind, the ACP and the AAFP actually a year ago said maybe we should loosen the guidelines a little to 150. So I suppose, like everything else in life, we are becoming divided into different camps arguing more aggressive or less aggressive approach. It's not that one group is wrong and one group is right. It's that I think for individual patients, we're going to have to make individual decisions. And you simply cannot issue a decree that affects everybody from age 18 to 88. I think that there is too much difference there. That's our opinion here at Health Matters. Shelly's nodding with me. Mm-hmm. Rick's nodding off asleep.
Yeah.
So I guess we're going
to... I'm about to sneeze. Hold on.
don't hold it.
Yeah. No, pinch your nose. Let's see what happens. I'm interested in this now.
I do. Can I say something about the blood pressure?
You
before
can say whatever you want.
You know, the one thing that would help everybody, no matter what their age, is the positive lifestyle changes. I mean, their number one point, I think, is critical when we think about treating any patient for anything.
Alcohol in moderation, regular physical exercise, increase your potassium, and that's really fresh fruits and vegetables, decrease your sodium, and that's probably helpful. And again, that is both table salt, but 80% of your sodium comes from foods, pre-prepared foods. If you look at the sodium on the label, you're trying to keep that under 2,000 milligrams. The American Heart Association actually chose 1,500 milligrams, which is a very strict salt restriction. But if you do those things just universally, you will be in better health. And anybody can do that. Increasing your physical activity, alcohol in moderation, and fresh fruits and vegetables and less processed food, that's good for anybody. And yeah. I absolutely agree with you. And that's where we start. And if we can get really good at that, we may be able to prevent a number of diseases, not just heart attack or stroke, and we won't have to take extra pills. We've got to stop taking so many pills. All right, Rick, wake up. This thanks for that. I appreciate it. This was New York Times, and it was absolutely amazing.
You read the New York Times?
I read this one because it had a movie in it, and I liked the movie. This was January 18th, New York Times. Drone saves two swimmers in Australia.
Must have been a big drone.
Well, you know, initially, that's what I thought.
I'm okay, joking.
So, well, I wasn't. I didn't know how it worked. But there was a practice session for Australian lifeguards. They were testing a new drone, and it turned into a real rescue when the drone helped save two swimmers at a beach in New South Wales. They found two young men caught in a real turbulent surf, 10-foot swells. They were struggling, obviously. So you see this movie, the drone is flying along, and of course you see the waves and the swells and so forth. And all of a sudden there's two black dots in one of the swells, and it was two young men swimming. And they were quite a ways offshore, and these were pretty darn big swells. So the drone then swoops down, and it deploys a self-inflating life raft. It was a yellow log, essentially, that they both grabbed onto. Smoke came out. I suppose that was probably a flare that they dropped to mark their location. And they captured all that.
Wouldn't the GPS on board the drone have their location?
That could be, but I don't have a GPS when I'm out swimming, or mine might have gotten
wet.
But
once the drone locates them, we know where the drone is.
In my skivvies. So the rescue took 70 seconds. And then, I mean, they had to go out and get them, and so the rescue wasn't complete. But in 70 seconds, they were able to take care of these guys. And he said it would have taken minutes longer on a normal day, and these were pretty big swells. The drone's name is Little Ripper. I don't know why. It's an unmanned aerial vehicle. It has an algorithm that automatically recognizes sharks. So they got this drone flying around looking for sharks, but if it sees swimmers, it can drop off a life raft for them, and they can wait it out until they get rescued. And
I wonder if they drop a flotation device that's a color sharks like.
It was yellow.
Because they're looking for sharks.
Yeah. So
there's swimmers out there with the sharks.
According to Michael Blumenstein, a professor at University of Technology in Sydney, who oversaw the team, developed the shark spotting software, the applications in the water are phenomenal. The amount of payload these drones can carry enables them to be really versatile. With a rough surf, remote locations, natural disasters, where time's a factor. And so right away, I mean, as soon as you hear this, as soon as I read this, I thought, well, of course, this is perfect. I always thought being a beach lifeguard was tough because, you know, they come down off the towers and they have to run out into the surf to save somebody. And if somebody's having trouble, it's because the surf is really big. It's hard to run out there. So this thing just flying along above the surface and drops the float, I thought, this is perfect. I could do that. I now can be a Baywatch lifeguard.
No, you couldn't.
I just got my
No,
little,
he could. He really could. He could be one. People wouldn't want to. I mean, we wouldn't have to look at him though.
Well,
he could
I wouldn't
be in a room
that's the
somewhere.
Thing. That's the thing. I could be down in the basement with my guiding my drone.
No, Tony. There's a lot of discussion about how drones. I mean, we talk about people. I heard a discussion the other day. I overheard a couple of guys talking about this, and it came out of the CES stuff. People were worried that robots are going to take their job, specifically like maybe because there's been a lot of talk about trucks, right? So we'll drive down the interstate. A truck driver may feel like they're going to lose their, you know, they're going to have some harder time keeping a job. But then the other person that was talking said, well, you know, I'm not entirely sure the truck is the first guy that ought to worry. I think if I was worried, I think I'd be the ambulance driver because the ambulance drivers are having to go through traffic. And this a drone, on the other hand, picks the patient up, takes them straight to the hospital. And, oh, by the way, most hospitals already have a place for it to land. So now it's just a matter of can they have the time frame to get from the helipad to the patient? Is there enough battery life and enough? And, I mean, they can. I mean, so yeah, paramedics may show up on scene, put them in a drone, and send them back to the hospital, and they're there in 2 minutes without having to go back and navigate traffic. So I thought it was an interesting discussion of how one person was thinking about truck drivers, the other person was thinking about the utility of drones, which really that's what this is about. This is about the utility of robotic devices or drones.
You know, and my dad, of course, he's since passed, but my dad would have awakened about halfway to the hospital, and he would have fought the drone the rest of the way there. Alien abductions are not a laughing matter for my dad.
Well, You know, there is that, but I'm just saying, I think, you know.
But a young person who is reasonably with it.
That is actually a pretty interesting idea. Take a flotation device to somebody who needs a flotation device using a drone.
Oh, that's perfect. Now, my first thought of, I guess it dropped a rope, what it towed them in or things like that. No, but you could certainly drop a flotation device and mark their location.
Now, I don't know that this is designed for it, but there are half a dozen YouTube videos you can go search and find of a person taking a drone and hooking their saltwater, you know, their ocean lure or bait to a drone. The drone flies out past the surf, looks where the fish are, drops the bait where the fish are, because, you know, usually saltwater, you can see the fish in schools, drops the bait to it, and then they have to reel it in like 400 yards, but they end up catching fish, guaranteed, and they're usually larger. So, I mean, this is just somebody figuring out how to use a drone to...
Well, isn't that sort of like shooting deer out of your pickup truck?
Well, not exactly. It's legal.
I think we're going to have to get some fishing rules here.
But I'm just saying.
I hear what you're saying.
We're going to continue to be amazed by the utility of robotics, automation, drones. You know, the next 10 years are just going to be fascinating for us.
Aren't they noisy? I mean, that's the thing I worry is that I'm out swimming and then all these drones are flying overhead constantly.
If you're needing a life safety device, are you really going to worry about the sound?
No, but I'm saying, you know, I'm swimming along the beach and the lifeguards are nowhere to be seen. Meanwhile, there are half a dozen drones just patrolling back and forth. Yes, they will tell me if there's a shark, but on the other hand, they're really annoying.
Yeah, I don't know that the drones will be patrolling as much as the drones get... You know, there's cameras already in, you know, watching those areas from some high level, and then you deploy the drone when needed. I don't know that they just patrol. The robots will be patrolling the beach.
Okay.
I don't know that I could hear the drone over the surf.
Oh, maybe not. Of course, if you try to fly a kite, then you might notice. But and people do fly. That would be me. I'm up in
you'll be the one flying the kite that knocks the drone down, and the people don't get their life safety. Yeah.
Better than that, you know, the things they tow behind the boats. I would be up there
parasailing
when I get hit by a drone. And anyway, it could happen.
I was actually on my farm the other day. A drone came flying by. It flew over my barn. It turns out it was my neighbors, but you know they were just playing around with a toy. But it was pretty funny. You know, it took me a while to figure out what that noise was, and I realized, they're flying a drone.
Was it loud?
It was loud enough to where I could hear it 2 acres away, 2 or 3 acres away. So, yeah, it was. But, you know, granted, this was one of the more home style. They were flying around playing, taking pictures.
I think that thing was hauling a raft.
Tony, I know you're a guy who personally surveys your land and walks. I know a lot of people who fly them around their property lines just so they can see their property line.
Hey, it would be glorious, wouldn't it? we'll survey your property. Survey your radio.
Send you a flotation device.
And we'll come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. No, that's not a drone you're hearing. That's Rick Phillips.
This is Shelley Irving.
But he does tend to drone on. I'll give him that. I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Health Matters Shutdown Show, celebrating the shutdown and the resurrection
of
the United
States government.
You can
shut down everything, but you can't shut down Health Matters.
Well, I mean, you think about it. It was a 3-day shutdown, and then they arose. Where have we heard that before? I think we know where we're headed with all this, right?
Uh-oh.
You can't kill the government for more than 3 days. It arises. That's all I'm saying. Our sponsor for the final time, Hypertension Guidelines. When you treat your high BP, remember these guidelines. Three guidelines from the American College of Physicians. These are internal medicine physicians and the American Academy of Family Physicians. This is the largest group of family medicine doctors. And here are their three guidelines. Number one, initial treatment in people over age 60 should begin if the blood pressure is above 150 consistently. And that will lower the risk for mortality, for stroke, and for heart attacks. There is very strong evidence of this. Second thing, consider intensifying if there is a previous history of stroke to reach a target of less than 140. And then finally, consider intensifying if people are older and have a high cardiovascular risk. And the American College of Cardiology guidelines said American Heart Association guidelines said if it's above 10%, and you can use these risk calculators to figure that out. But back to the American College of Physicians, American Academy of Family Physicians guidelines, consider initiating or intensifying your medicine treatment in some older people who are at high risk to get their of having heart attacks, to get their blood pressure less than 140. That's the three and only three guidelines they made, as opposed to the American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association guidelines. And again, those say that you should consider using medication starting at 130, not 150, but at 130. And you should consider starting medications at 80 on the bottom number if a person is at high risk. Those guidelines are controversial. The American Academy of Family Physicians has refused to endorse the American Heart Association guidelines. The American College of Physicians wrote a rather critical editorial of those guidelines, and I read the key points from that in our last fractional portion. Check that out on the Morehead State University website if you did not hear it. But that is our sponsor. Hypertension guidelines, when you treat your high BP, remember these guidelines three. The question is going to be which guidelines are going to prevail. I don't think looking at, we now have a half a dozen different cholesterol guidelines. I don't think that there's going to be one guideline disappear from view and the other one be accepted universally. But I think, as I see the criticisms mounting, I think the majority of physicians are going to go with the less stringent guidelines. Most of the time, the cardiologists, they fill in ranks, and they will probably if you see a cardiologist, they're going to treat your hypertension more aggressively than if you see an internal medicine doctor or a family physician. Whether or not that's going to be good for you, whether or not that's going to be worth the side effects, that's going to be individual. Hard to know. That's our sponsor. Very quickly, just want to say one message of hope. I saw this, it would have been 2 weeks before this show airs. They mentioned during the early part of the legislative session, this is the Kentucky legislative session, much discussion centered on the potential benefits of a $1 tax increase on cigarettes. It gained momentum. It was had an informational hearing by Senate Health and Welfare Committee, Kentucky Chamber of Commerce, as well as Kentucky's Cancer Center's specialist said that this would be a good idea. Keep in mind, smoking-related illnesses cause nearly 9,000 deaths in Kentucky each year, cost the state $2 billion annually, $700 million covered by the state's Medicaid program. Alice Forgy Kerr made the motion to recommend increasing the cigarette tax by $1. Senator Danny Carroll seconded the motion. And so there's where we are at the time we're recording this. We have hopes that after a long, it's been a decade, we may actually get further tax increase on cigarettes. And the idea here, again, is to make them expensive enough that young people do not start smoking regularly and that we can save a generation from becoming addicted to nicotine and suffering the fates of Kentuckians. 3,500 lung cancers per year in this state, the highest rate, five times the rate of that in Utah, the highest rate in the nation of lung cancer and lung cancer mortality, and close to 9,000 deaths from lung cancer, heart disease, and other forms of cancer and other diseases linked to cigarette smoking. The costs are kind of interesting. If people don't live very long, they don't take as much pension and retirement benefits. I'm not sure that you can say we're going to save a whole bunch of money on this tax. I do believe we're going to save a whole bunch of lives on this tax as it goes, because all other states, except for a handful, have a higher cigarette tax than we do and have lower rates of lung cancer and lower rates of smoking.
I would like to see the money used for not just tobacco cessation treatment, but also any sort of addiction treatment.
There would be many good uses for this money. Right now, I think the priorities seem to be pensions and Medicaid expansion. But however it is spent, the way it is acquired may actually do some good as well. We enthusiastically endorse it, but whether or not it will actually become law remains to be seen. Now, this was a report, the title of it was Decreases in Psychological Well-Being Among American Adolescents After 2012 and Links to Screen Time. They did a survey. It was published in the journal Emotion, not a journal that I read a lot. I tend to I'm a little too moody for that journal, I think. But a large survey of 8th, 10th, and 12th graders conducted annually by the University of Michigan, and they looked at their self-esteem, their life satisfaction, and so forth. And these things plunged after 2012. Now, keep in mind, I mean, the economic recession was 2008. If you want to talk about politics, Congress essentially changed hands in 2016. But in 2012, in the middle of the Obama two-term administration, self-esteem and satisfaction plunged. Now, one of the reasons they think is smartphone ownership reached 50% mark in the U.S., and adolescent psychological well-being decreased with more hours a week they spent on screens beyond a certain time. Now, if you do not have a screen, if you do not have a smartphone, you are an unhappy person because, one, you don't have any friends. Two, you may not have any money. There are a bunch of reasons why you are not satisfied at all. As you do a little bit of communications, of social networking and so forth, your satisfaction goes up, but it peaks. And what they said was the least happy teenagers, the happiest ones were 1 to 5 hours a week, happier than those that get none at all. The least happy ones were ones who use screen for 20 or more hours per week.
Do you think that has to do with cyberbullying? I think that plays into this for that age group.
I think there's that. I think there's obviously the comparison to other people on Facebook who are having a better time than you are. I think also just the fact of sitting in front of a screen is not linked to long-term satisfaction and high self-esteem. You know, basically, if you're a teenager especially, sports mean a lot to you. Outdoors, meeting people from the opposite sex, and not so much on being on a screen.
I don't know where I am on this one.
I know, tough. 20 hours. I mean, you can say, certainly, I think everyone would agree that there is a point past which you're probably overdoing it. Now, to say that it was 20 hours, that's almost back to the American Academy of Pediatrics. Their old 2 hours a day guidelines.
Right.
These were people that apparently, they did their homework, they did whatever they needed to do, and then they put the equipment down and did something else.
I don't know. This one always gets me, just because there was a time when screens were a problem because there was only one thing on the screen and that was TV. You know, then there became computers where they were part of people's job. Well, then they got smaller. Then they went to tablets. Then they got onto phones. Now you can't make a bank transaction without looking at a screen. So I almost think that at some point when you start looking at restrictions, you have to look at what type of activity are you doing, right? So is it 2 hours a day of screen time for playing games? And is that so that it kind of helps not build that compulsive, you know, personality for playing games all the time or you get addicted, right? So, I mean, is it more that we got to keep you from being a gamer, or is it more that we got to keep you from spending too much time on social media because social media can portray the more, how do you say it? It's an extreme, right? So you see everybody's extreme. It could be their extreme niceness. It could be their extreme anger. It could be their, you know, there's nothing, unless you're looking at recipes, and those aren't necessarily, those are pretty extreme sometimes too.
I doubt the teenagers are looking at recipes.
I get it, but we're talking about screen time for lots of people. You know,
right.
And
did you have limits on your kids' screen time?
No, but we tried to keep them engaged in doing things with us, right? I mean, it was really hard for me to sit on a computer for 8 hours and tell my kids, you can't do this. I try not to be the do as I say, not as I do guy.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's about what's on their screen, right? Now, you can imagine living with me wasn't fun because there wasn't anything electronic.
I can visualize this, let me tell you.
There wasn't anything electronic that I didn't know they were doing, right? So you weren't going to pull the wool over Dad's eyes.
Yeah, you know, there was that movie about the guy whose father-in-law was an ex-CIA. This is Ben Stiller, I think of you as the electronic version of that father-in-law.
Probably. Maybe not quite as extreme, but to me, you know, social media represents extremes. It represents just everybody's extreme. You see some people that all they post is the happy things, and you know good and well they have ups and downs in their life. You just don't see the downs. Then the other people you see, all they post is the downs. But they never post the happy things.
What are you doing, I guess, with your son
with our son. So he has a Kindle, and he's really
upset with us. That's a book.
Well, you know, you can put games and little videos on it too. But we have it set to where he has to read books for a certain amount of time before it will open up the other things. And then it shuts off at bedtime.
I will tell you, we did not have this problem. We had my children are older. We have one computer in the living room, which they could
use. Yeah, but let's be honest. Your computer didn't have internet.
It barely had internet. I will tell you, we get no cell phone service in my house.
You heard modem tones before you got.
That's
true. You clicked on the little Earth
link. We were out in the middle of nowhere, so they could go to their heart's content, but they couldn't actually access the World Wide Web, which made it a little less. An unrelated fact, just to let you know, the percentage of teens who had smartphones jumped from 37% in 2012 to 73% in 2015 to 89% by the end of 2016. So if your child doesn't have a smartphone, and again, we're talking about, we said 8th, 10th, and 12th graders. So by 8th grade, if your child doesn't have a smartphone, your child is in the bottom 11%.
Apparently by 3rd grade, because I have the uncool child in 3rd grade who does not have a cell phone.
Yeah.
And no intention to get him one anytime soon.
But the other thing, Rick, to your point, the author was, her name is Jean Twenge. She's a psychology professor at San Diego State. She's also the author of Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. So this was not an unbiased scientist interpreting data. She's got a book that says that that they're less happy, and so she found some data that went along with their book. And that's not necessarily a conflict of interest, but I do feel that if you have already published a certain opinion, then you're not as likely to publish data that contradicts your book that you're trying to sell.
Well, it's the same reason we don't have a lot of book reviews on this show, right? And how many get sent to us?
Yeah, yeah.
We
used to, before people kind of wised up, we used to get books all the time that they thought we'd review, and we don't review. First of all, we don't read very much.
They make great kindling.
So at any rate, I think, though, it comes back, as you said, the idea now is that parents and children should spend time together. If we're going to do screen work, then we probably ought to do these screens together as much as we can. I think you need to think about what's on the screen. That's Rick's point. The American Academy of Pediatrics still has a 2 hours per day, I believe, but some data indicates that they ought to back off that. This data indicated for teenagers that about 3 hours a day or less was a sweet spot, but I find it's biased information. I'm not buying it. I brought this not necessarily to tell people that 20 hours a week is the number you strive for, but simply to say, yeah, there is a number somewhere, and that you can't just buy your children these electronic devices and walk away. As a matter of fact, Twinge and others have pressured Apple. They said, look, you're making an addictive toy for kids. You need to put some safeguards into this thing. You need to alter your operating system to account for the fact that kids are spending too much time on it. It would be like making detergent pods look like candy. You know, there is a corporate responsibility.
Is that not the stupidest thing going on right now?
Yes. We're talking, of course, about Tide Pods. Not necessarily health matters.
That's Darwin. Right, that's natural selection. I mean, that is idiotic. I can't believe that somebody would do it as a dare. Why don't they? I mean, they certainly wouldn't go to your laundry room and grab the Tide and drink it. I don't know. I find this is idiot. And the people doing this as a dare are just dumb. Mm-hmm. Now I feel bad for the people who get injured and hurt in it because their own stupidity is causing them. Well, you know, grief, and they're causing grief for all the people around them.
You know, part of me feels bad for the Poison Control Center people. You call them up, and you. I mean, we would call them. We had them on speed dial when our kids were young because we were not sure our kids might be drinking gasoline. They ate a spider, you know, that sort of thing. Kids do this sort of stuff, and you got to get some information. And we were worried.
It makes my mud pies look tame.
Yeah, but by the same token, a teenager or a person older than that who says, "Oh, I just ate some detergent. What do I do?" You got to say if
we were going to throw up violently.
Yeah. Don't hold your nose.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, those of you who are holding your nose during our show, you can let go because we're going to get off the air.
Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilry, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters is a breakthrough heart failure radio show that can help make more tomorrows possible.
Health Matters is used to reduce the risk of death and hospitalization in people with certain types of long-lasting heart failure. It is usually used with other heart failure radio shows.
Health Matters can harm or cause death to your unborn baby. Mm. Talk to your doctor about other radio shows for heart failure if you plan to become pregnant. You should either listen to Health Matters or breastfeed. You should not do both.
Now, that's good advice.
Tell your doctor about all the medicines you take, including prescription and over-the-counter medicines, vitamins, and herbal supplements. Especially tell your doctor if you take potassium supplements or other medicines for high blood pressure.
The most common side effects of our show were low blood pressure, high potassium, cough, dizziness, and kidney problems.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and why not make a high blood pressure change? That is, get more exercise, get less salt, eat more fruits and vegetables, and alcohol in moderation, if at all. But whatever you do, tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.